Welcome to episode 19 of the Zach Kuhn Show. Here we go. Today's guest is manager Chris Cappy. Now, I got to tell you, all you ever hear in Nashville about Cappy is, Chris Cappy, nicest guy in town, nicest guy ever. I mean, that is what everybody says about him. And, you know, a couple people knew that I was interviewing him before I did, and they just go, Cappy, love Cappy, the nicest guy in town. I mean, that is what everyone says about him. And I got to tell you, he lived up to the hype big time. I mean, so nice, so laid back. Instantly, I wanted to be in the Chris Cappy camp. I mean, he was just so inviting, so warm, so friendly. Loved talking with him. And this is the manager's episode. If you're a manager, if you want to be a manager, if you're trying to figure out how to get into management, this is the episode for you. I think the biggest takeaway for me was it's all about the fans. That's what it comes down to, the fans. How do you service them? And we talk all about that in this episode. I can't wait for you guys to hear it. Quick side note, the audio in this episode sometimes gets a little bit funky, but bear with it. You'll pretty much be able to make out everything, no problem. And that's it. That's all I'm going to say. Let's dive in.
Are you driving back from Florida?
I'm actually driving away down to Florida.
Down to Florida. Fantastic. Yeah. How was the wedding?
It was great. We had a really good, it was a really nice night.
Fantastic. You know, when a client starts dating someone or gets engaged, do you think that person feels a pressure to impress the manager? Is it a little bit like meeting the parents?
You know what? Not really, but it really depends on the relationship you have with your artist and everything. But no, not at all. I mean, we're just all friendly. I mean, hell, I wanted to probably impress her more than she had wanted to impress me. So, no, it's great, man. We had a nice time, and they're an amazing couple. And I think a lot of people will look at them and say, man, I want what they have, because they have a really special thing.
Absolutely. So I believe also that you and I share like a spiritual mentor that I've read that when you first started management, you would watch the movie Supermensch like every 10 days. Chef Gordon, do you still watch that movie often?
All the time. I was actually listening to the book as I was driving. So the audio book. Yeah. So Luke is the one who brought it to me very early on. He's like, I need you to watch this. You're going to love this. This is all about, this guy is just like you. And I watched it and I fell in love with it. And then in December 2018, I got to have lunch with Shep in Hawaii. And that was spiritual.
Holy cow. Now, he says in the movie that his door is always open. Is that how that lunch came together? Did you reach out to him, or how did you fly out to Hawaii just for that lunch? How did that come together?
That's a great question. Now, Luke was playing a BMI Songwriters event in Maui, and then when that happened, I reached out to Gary Gersh and John Huey. Reached up and said, hey, this is Cappy, he's a huge fan, if you had time. And I met Chef, and he's like, yeah, let's have lunch together. So I went to his country club, and I enjoyed some ahi tuna, and I got an hour with him of undivided attention, and it was awesome.
Holy cow. What, do you still pick out nuggets when you listen to the book right now, or when you watch
Absolutely.
The movie again?
Absolutely. Every time I'm in it, if I'm in a place where I can't figure out where to go with something, I'll put the movie on. And then if it takes 5 minutes or if it takes 30 minutes or if it takes to the next day, something will click and I will get my answer that I need. So it just lets me take my head out of it and dive back into it. So, it's great.
I love that. One of my favorite scenes in the movie is when he talks about how there was someone famous on his property and a photographer was taking photos of that person and they didn't want his photos to be out in the public. So he says, okay, give me the photos and I'll give you the exclusive rights to his wedding, right?
Yep.
And he's always, he's always making sure that it's a win-win situation for everyone is what it comes across.
It's fantastic. I mean, I think my favorite thing that he ever did was going back and paying all the bad checks that he bounced to people.
Right.
They had the money and paying all that back. Like, that just tells you kind of the guy who he is. And I'm a big believer in that. Like, he is a super mensch, and I just think it's amazing.
Absolutely. So did you grow up listening to music? Were you a music fan when you were growing up?
No, I actually wasn't. A lot of people are obsessed with music. where they read the liner notes and all that kind of stuff. I was a fan of just, like, music. Like, I enjoyed music, but I tried to play it. I couldn't get it. So when that happened, I just enjoyed music as a kid. I was listening to what my mom and dad were playing in the house and that kind of stuff, but I never became obsessed with it until college. College is when I became obsessed with music. Younger, I played golf. You know, I ran around with the kids in the neighborhood. I never got into video games or anything like that. So it was more about experiences, me, and that kind of stuff. So it wasn't until college that I was like live shows and that kind of stuff. And that's where I became obsessed with music.
And then you started to work in the tech space in Atlanta. Was that right after college?
Yeah, right after college. Well, right after college, I was actually a golf pro at a country club for 4 years. And then I got into the tech space, yeah. And then I did the tech space for a few years. And then jumped in with a company called Six Man and went from making really good money and having an easy life and stuff like that to, you know, my buddy comes to me and goes, "Hey, man, you want to get into the music business?" I'm like, "Yeah, that sounds like a fun thing. Let's do it. Then I can do that." He's like, "Oh, I'm going to pay you a third of what you're making." And I'm like, "That sounds like a good idea. Let's do that."
So,
and,
I mean, you knew that this guy was your fraternity brother. You knew him pretty well, and he was starting this cruise ship business. And
yeah,
to me, hindsight's always 20/20, but to me that sounds kind of crazy that your friend is like, "I'm going to start this cruise ship business on the water. You know, come work for me. You're making six figures. You're going to make, you know, a fraction of that." Was it, I mean, how did that not sound crazy to you? What pushed you into that?
I hated a 9-to-5 job. I hated answering phones. I hated talking about technology. I had no passion about it. I didn't care. But I love music. I love the water. And, you know, it just sounded like a way more fun. Like, you know, and that's where I originally was like, "Man, I want to be a manager one day," because he was a manager. And I was like, "I want to do this one day." And, you know, that's when it all started in 2000. You know, so it took 15 years to get to that point where I met Luke and started with Luke. But, you know, I think the thing that happened that was great was I learned what I wanted and what I needed in an artist. And I learned so much about the fans. And that's really what drives everything, is the fans. So that's what I wanted to do, is make sure that I had a great base of knowledge, and that's what I got from Six Man. I learned how to work with super passionate, awesome fan bases.
So you leave your job in Atlanta, you go work for Six Man, and at that point, was he already up and running, onto the cruise ships right away, or was he still
building?
No,
we did the very first one together, and you know, it was an absolute nightmare scenario. Every scenario that could go wrong did, and we worked super hard and we got it done. And then, you know, Andy had his name is Andy Levine. He had such a vision, and it was nice to be around for that vision and kind of watch it happen, where it's like, take care of the artists, but care of the fans at the same time, and we did. And that's, again, going back and looking at that, I got to work with very passionate fan bases. Like, you know, Sister Hazel was the first act that did this, and, you know, we got to do really fun stuff with them. Their fans are super passionate. The Hazelnuts are super passionate fans. And so, you know, I got to work with them, and I got to work with, bands like, Tonic, Pat McGee, really just awesome, awesome people. And then, you know, they expanded from there. They went to Lynyrd Skynyrd and John Mayer, and, you know, they created a festival called Kayama, which was very Americana-based. And,
right,
again, it was great to work with just super passionate fan bases and super passionate artists that love their fans. So for 15 years, I essentially got a PhD in fan interaction, and I just use that to this day for all my artists and how they interact with their fans.
Were concerts on cruises, I feel like now that's sort of a known thing. 15 years ago, was it being done as much as it's being done today?
Or I think no. The only person that did it was a guy named Delbert McClinton out of Tennis. Outside of that, I don't think it was done. I think Andy was a pretty much a pioneer, or at least a pioneer in growing it to where it turned into the business that it is today.
Were most of the artists excited about the idea, or did you have to convince them that it wasn't going to be crazy to to play in the middle of the ocean.
I think you had to convince him to be locked on a ship with people, you know. The funny thing is that, you know, once you do it once, those artists became the biggest advocates for doing it with other artists. Like, they would call him up and be like, it's not what you think, it's actually really great. And it turned out to be one of those things where the artists are loving to do it. You know, it's a really cool concept. It's, you know, it's essentially it's a giant event for the super fans to get together and essentially have like a backstage pass for 2,500 people. I mean, you're going to see Kiss in a room that only holds 2,500 people. You can't do that anywhere else. I mean, that was so cool to be able to do that and watch that interaction happen. So I learned a lot from those years. I learned a lot.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening and hope you're enjoying the show. Some of you may know that I run an industry newsletter called the Nashville Briefing. It really takes you to the front row of everything happening in our industry. And if you want to learn more about it, you can go to nashvillebriefing.com to subscribe. Also, if you're enjoying this show and specifically this episode, please feel free to give us a 5-star review on your podcast listening platform. Thanks so much. Now back to the show. So you're on Sixth Man for, you know, over a decade, and then, I mean, kind of almost, I guess I could say famously at this point, you stumble into the 40 Watt Club, and you see Luke Combs playing. How did you stumble into that venue that night? What brought you there?
Well, it really wasn't a stumble. So what happened was Bradley Jordan, who owns a company called Peach Street Entertainment, is a very, I mean, this guy finds talent. I mean, he found everybody before anybody else did. He has a knack for it. Bradley had called me up. I was living in California at the time, working for Sixth Man. And he called me up and said, hey, man, you need to move back. I know you've always wanted to be a manager. You need to move back and chase your dream. And we're best friends since we were kids. So he convinces me to move back to Atlanta, the Atlanta area, and I do. And then he sees Luke playing a show that he promoted in Rome, Georgia, and said, I found your guy. Like, this is your guy. You need to manage this guy. And I'm like, okay, well, then how do we do it? He goes, well, I talked to him, and he has an open Saturday. And the open Saturday is Memorial Day weekend in 2015. And I know the 40 Watt is open. I was like, Bradley, the 40 Watt is open because nobody else is doing a show because it's Labor Day weekend in a college town. Nobody's going to go to the show. Because it's the only weekend he has open, you got to do it. So we buy the show. It was $750. We bought the show. And then we had to get the 40 Watt. And essentially, we bought the show so I could see Luke play. And we get there, and I'm expecting nobody to even show up. I'm expecting it to be like me, Luke, and Bradley, and that's it. And I'm watching Soundcheck. And this is the first time that Luke ever played Hurricane live. So the band was still working it up during Soundcheck. They were rehearsing it. They asked us to print out lyrics, and Luke sent them to us, and they had them on the stage, so the guys knew what BGB is to sing. And I see Luke during soundcheck. I'm like, man, this guy can sing, like really sing, like this is really good. And then at Doors, we had a line. There's 83 people that showed up to see this show, and I was blown away. They knew every word to every song that Luke had out there on the 2 EPs and then Hurricane. So 7 songs, and they were singing every word. And I was like, man, this guy's got it. This guy has it. And I was like, I want to be involved in that. So that's when the conversation started.
So, and does your friend, you know, you bought the show, so you kind of had it there. Do you go up to him afterwards and – did he buy on to you right away? Did you have to convince him?
No. I had to convince him. So I got to be really close with the guitar player, Rob Williford, who is so close to Luke. And I started talking to him. I said, hey, man, what is this guy looking for? And what is happening? And you know, we kind of got to be buddies. And then we booked him for another show. And then I called a buddy of mine who worked in Atlanta radio and said, hey, do you have anything, any show possible? Nobody knew who it was. And he goes, you know what? We just had an opening for a festival, like a city festival in Dahlonega, Georgia. Got a couple $1,000s. Would he be open? I'm like, yes, he'll do it. Yeah, like, let me set this up. So we did. And I called up Luke, and I go, hey, I got you a radio show. He's like, wow, you're already working for me. And, you know, we're not even working together. I'm like, yeah, you should do this. And got him on the radio show. And we got that done. And then, you know, he talked to a couple other managers in town, and, you know, a lot of them didn't see the potential, luckily. And he called me up and said, hey, I met with some other managers. You know, what do you see me doing? And I said, well, what did they say? And he came back and he goes, no, I want to know what you want to say before I tell you what they said. I said, well, I think you're a star, and you should be singing your songs every night in front of people. And he said, when can you move to town? You're my manager. And I was like, wow. Yeah, everybody said I had a really great voice, but I didn't have the look that they were looking for. So it's time, you know, you believe in me, and, you know, you're going to work hard for me, so let's do this. And that's how it all happened.
Now, I think that line that Luke just said of, you know, everyone says I have the voice but not the look is maybe like a, you know, maybe a key part of the early Luke story, that he's almost kind of like the underdog. And, you know, everyone's telling him this, but you saw him firsthand. You saw the fan engagement. You saw the power he had on stage. Did that ever cross your mind, or did you say, screw that? I mean, look at the way the fans are freaking out.
Yeah, it was all about the fans. It was never about his looks, not one time, actually. It was about the fans. Like, you can't, like, when you see fans singing at the top of their lungs, super excited about something like that, you can't recreate that. And you just had to embrace it, and I did. And I was like, you know, who cares about what you like? It was like, you know, you don't have the look. Well, what's the look? You know, he has the songs. He has the voice. Why not work with that? You know,
totally.
It never made sense to me.
And when you saw him in the club, it's funny, I was talking to Sherrod Robertson last week on my podcast, and he says when Music Row came across his desk to buy Music Row, he knew 1,000% he was getting Music Row. It wasn't even a question. When you saw Luke in the club, did you have that feeling of, oh, 100%, this is going to be my guy?
Well, I was going to do everything I could to make it my guy. You know, I needed to show him what I bring to the table and the plan I put together for him. So, I mean, I sat down and did the whole thing, and I didn't want anybody else to beat me out. And luckily, you know, at the time, Nashville wasn't ready for Luke Combs, and I luckily was in the right place at the right time and, you know, showed. I mean, you got to remember, I jumped in the van and started driving the van. You know, at 42 years old, I was driving the van. I was selling merch. I was booking hotel rooms, advancing shows. I mean, I was doing everything that he needed for nothing, you know, because there was no money coming in either. So I don't think anybody else even wanted to deal with it, because there was a lot to it. And I was okay with that, though. I embraced that. Like, that was my thing. I was like, yeah, let's go, man. I'm all about it.
And were you booking those early shows? Were you able to pull an agent in at that point?
We pulled an agent in very early because of Bradley. I mean, Bradley was the one who got it all kind of dialed in and said, I'll be booking these shows, and got the agent. But all the shows were booked through Bradley. So, you know, it really was Bradley doing it all. So, if we needed a show, the agent would call Bradley. Bradley would book the show and handle everything and take the loss early on. If there was one, or would break even or whatever on these early shows. And you know, that's why Bradley is still our promoter for the state of Georgia and Alabama. If we're doing a Luke Combs show, it's Bradley Jordan and whoever he wants to pick along to do it, because that's the way it should be. He took the risk early on. He believed in it. And, you know, that's why he gets the shows.
Absolutely. So Luke calls you and he says, move to Nashville. You're my guy. Could you have done this outside Nashville? I mean, I'm assuming it was
no.
Clear. Okay, I had to move to Nashville.
Yeah, you have to be here. You have to be present to win. And with everything that was going on, there's no way I could do it. Like, I couldn't tour out of Atlanta for Nashville. I just had to pick up and go. So I loaded everything up and moved to Nashville.
Now, we know from Haley Withers that Nashville is notoriously a 10-year town. Obviously, you have, you know, over a decade of experience in the music industry. When you first got to Nashville, did you almost feel a little bit behind having not lived here? Or did you feel like you had to catch up? Or was the Luke thing just, you know, already running and you were so focused on that?
No, luckily I had connections in town from all the cruises that I had done. I mean, I knew Doc McKee and Ken Levitan and John Huey and Scott Clayton. I knew people in town already. And it would be funny because I didn't reach out to any of them, though, because I didn't want anybody to be like, oh, look, this is cute. Cappy's playing music business.
Right. Was that a concern? Did you think that in your head that people would be saying that?
Absolutely. I said, you know what, I'm just going to focus on Luke and our fans and our shows, and that's all I'm going to worry about. And that's all I did worry about. I just wanted to make sure we put out the best show and the best experience for fans, and we would figure it out. So, you know, and I had worked with Leslie Fram and CMT in a previous life, too. So I didn't call anybody. I didn't call in any favors or anything. I let Luke, you know, be Luke, and we went out there and did it. You know, I mean, the only person I talked to was Lynn Oliver, who, you know, ends up being my business partner for Luke and everything like that. I called her because she's the only person in town I even really knew and trusted. And I didn't play her any of his music or tell her any about it until, like, the third time we even hung out. So I just came to town and put my head down and focused on Luke.
Now, speaking of Lynn and that partnership, and then also with Haley Witters, you know, that's partnered with Matt Grant Brand Management. Do you enjoy, or is there something to be benefited from doing a partnership like that? Is that a strategy that you look for or that you seek out?
You know, I don't seek it out, but, I mean, Lynn's so smart, knows so much about the business, and her instincts and her intuition are some of the best I've ever seen. So, and, you know, we did this together. So, like, you know, with Luke, I was just like, you know, she wanted to start an independent record label. And she did, and we signed Luke to it. Like, we were always the underdogs. And then, you know, Lynn had way, way better instinct on where to take the label side of it. And she knew that I was really good with the touring side of it and the fan interaction side of it. So it was almost a smart thing for us to, like, team up on it. It was almost written in the stars. And, you know, we did that. And then, you know, she brought Nico Moon to me. You know, I brought Luke to her, and she brought Nico to me, and I heard Nico's stuff, and I was like, man, this is great. And then, you know, Matt Graham and I go back to when I used to live in Atlanta years ago with Six Man. You know, Matt wanted me to hire him at Six Man. Like, that's the first job he wanted to have. And then years later, we ran into each other on the carpet at CMT Awards. And I was like, what are you doing here? He's like, well, I manage Midland. I was like, well, I manage Luke. And then we said we always wanted to work on something together. And then when Haley came along, it was just a natural fit for both of us. Like, we just said, hey, let's work on Haley Winters together. And, you know, it really fit well together. So I enjoy doing the co-management thing.
Absolutely. So I wrote an article about how the Beatles broke in America in the 60s. And one of the interesting things was that they broke because prior to playing the Ed Sullivan Show, they had four singles in the market because of a screw-up with the label. They got dropped. They were on VJ. They were on Swan. They had four singles in the market, and when they played the Ed Sullivan Show, the fans knew four songs, as opposed to most acts at the time, they would have known one. And when I was thinking that, I was thinking, that's kind of similar to the Luke Combs strategy, because I feel like when I first learned about Luke Combs, I learned about, like, four songs at one time. Like, it wasn't like I was waiting for the next one. Like, when I heard him, he already had a catalog of, you know, hit songs that I was able to consume at once when I wanted more. I mean, how did that part of the strategy come together where, I mean, early on, it felt like you guys were just releasing and still just constantly releasing music and very timely with the moment, with 6 feet apart. Was that a clear part of the strategy early on, just releasing music?
Well, Luke had released two EPs with three songs in each EP before he and I ever even met. So he was putting out music on his own because people were wanting it from his Vine followers and social media. So, and that's how Luke was making money. So, you know, his TuneCore was, you know, keeping him alive just off those songs. And then, you know, we put out Hurricane, and then, you know, Lynn did that independently. We did Hurricane, and then we did a six-song EP, which it eventually rolled up into This One's For You. But I think, you know, Luke had all the music already. I mean, when I met Luke, he already had two EPs and the six songs already ready to go. So he was chugging along, man. Nothing was stopping him. He was going to go. And then, you know, like 6 feet apart, perfect example. He wrote a great song. It was a great opportunity. And we were able to put it out very quickly in a timely manner. But, I mean, the guy writes songs all the time. He's always writing and doing really awesome stuff. So it's just, it's fun to be a part of.
when you guys break another record or a streaming record or a chart record or whatever it is, I feel like it happens every couple of weeks or every couple of months. Do you get sick of that? Do you still love that feeling? Like what does that feel like when something like that happens?
Well, it's just you see all the hard work, and sometimes, you know, your head is down, but, you know, you have to take your head up and look around and be like, man, this is really fun. But it's, you know, when you're working with your best friends, like Lynn and Luke and I, it truly is like working with your best friends. You never get tired of that. I mean, you look at a guy like Luke and say, man, this guy deserves everything that he's getting because he's such a good person. I mean, the guy's got a heart bigger than the state of Texas. So you just love to see him win. And he's so humble. And, you know, the guy is still the same guy that was driving a Dodge Neon that he was 5 years ago when I first met him. He is not any different. He is still the same guy. I really wish I could say he's different, but he's not. He's who he is. He will give you the shirt off his back. I've seen it.
Unbelievable. I mean, so a lot of managers will, or, you know, some managers, I should say, will, you know, get their superstar client and they will, you know, put all their energy onto that client, you know, for better or worse. And, you know, they'll ride that for their entire career or whatever it is. It feels like you quickly started diversifying the roster, bringing on other clients. Now, you had said that Lynn brought you Mika. Was that an intentional strategy to start expanding the roster, or did it just kind of happen? How did you start finding more and more clients?
It was. And, you know, early on, I screwed up and signed a couple of other artists that I wasn't ready for because I didn't know how to build a company. I didn't know how to do any of that. And I failed very early on in my expansion process with some other people. And, you know, when you can learn from your failures, and again, fail forward is the best thing to do. And I failed forward. I made some bad decisions, and you know, I let some people down, and that weighs heavily on me. So when I went to expand from that point on, I looked at my past. I said, what did you do wrong? Don't do that again. And do it this way. And I started to expand slowly, and then it just started to happen where other people would start coming in, and other artists and other, like, people that I met. And I was like, I need you on my team. I need you. How do we make this happen? Well, let's go from there. And we just kind of grew it that way.
Any things you're doing now, or anything you're doing differently now that you know, you maybe screwed early on and you go, God, I'm so glad I'm doing this the way I'm doing this now?
People. Culture, people and culture. Like, if I meet a person now that's a really awesome person and has a great culture fit, and I have the ability to hire them, I'll hire them and figure out where to put them. I think that's the biggest fit, is finding the right people. I luckily have hired, the last three hires I've made have all been great culture fits, and just slotting them into the business where they fit. And we're going to have three great managers eventually one day when they're ready. But I couldn't let them go because they're just such good people.
That's awesome. So Haley Witters is really in her moment right now. I mean, it's so exciting to see what's happening with her. How'd you first get connected with her?
I forgot about it, but Haley was on the same day we were on with Luke. And Haley had two shows with us, one at Wendell's Pivot Brand in Anderson, South Carolina, and I want to say somewhere in Darlington. And she was opening, and she reminds me, she goes, Kathy, you walked me to my car every night, you made sure I was safe, you got me from the green room to the stage. I'm like, wow, I don't even remember that. I'm sorry. And it was, that's how we really met. So it goes to show you, you should treat everybody, you know, great, no matter who they are. And then I had a phone call, you know, about a year ago from some guys over at CAA that said, hey, Haley Witters is looking for management. Would you be open to it? I said, who else is talking to her? And they ran off names. And they said, Matt Graham. I called up Matt and said, let's do this together. And then I called Haley. And then a few months, and then ended up, she married work management, and we got over Haley together. And we're kind of, you know, with his experience with Midland and my experience with Luke, you know, we're able to kind of craft this great story and concept around Haley.
Now, I mean, there's so much, you know, there is such a great story around her, especially like the partnership with Big Loud and Songs of Dars. Was that, how did that come together? Was that something that you guys were chasing down, that kind of partnership?
We started taking label meetings. I got to give everything to Nicole Galyon, though. Nicole Galyon has been such a fan of Haley as a writer and artist that they actually thought that we had a deal that was off the table. And when they found out that it wasn't, they came full bore. You know, Steph and Nicole both, like, we want this, we love this. And it was very refreshing to kind of hear their model and where they were going with it and why they wanted to be involved. And it was a very easy decision to make.
Now, what's it been like working with, like an artist like her? It feels like her moment has come during quarantine. So you can't really hit the road and, you know, maybe do some of the typical things. How has, you know, working with an artist like her on the rise been during quarantine versus like when you were working with Moog when he was on the rise? Obviously, then you were on the road. But what's it been like working with an artist having their moment during quarantine?
Yeah, I think you know, I look at it this way. It's, the shows are just a portion of the overall experience. So, you know, Haley's able to write, focus on writing music right now, a lot of music. We're able to focus on content. We did that 10-year town piece where we talked to people in this city about their 10-year town. And we're able to have more moments. Like, we started her fan club called the Heartlanders, and we're able to talk to them and communicate with them. We're able to get creative. So when this thing ends, we have a very solid foundation of a fan base that we can interact with and go with. To kind of get out there. So I don't, you know, I know that the live music side of this is, you know, the biggest portion of it, but I'm really excited to see what artists are doing with the time to either hit reset, to create. I think some of the greatest music that we're going to hear for the next 5 years is going to come out of these, you know, crazy times that we're in right now. I think some amazing songs are going to be written right now because the artists have time to really reflect and create. I'm excited to see that.
Absolutely. Any great music that we should expect from Luke from quarantine? I'm sure the answer is yes.
Yes, that's all I'm going to say. You can expect some great music.
Fantastic. Unbelievable. And I have to ask, while I have you on the phone, Entertainer of the Year, it's got to go to Luke, right?
I hope so. You know, I'm very biased, but even if I wasn't Luke's manager, if you just looked at the measuring stick of streaming to sales to fans and that kind of stuff, I mean, it's hard to argue against him, but look, there's a lot of great people in this town. There's a lot of great artists. There's a lot of people having moments, but I have to say that my guy's moment is pretty big right now, and I would really love to see him win. I think he deserves it.
Absolutely.
I think he earned it. I don't think he did. You know, I think he earned it, and I think that's the big part. We'll see if his peers, and you know what, and if they don't, you know what, we have all our fans, and we will embrace them, and we will keep moving forward.
Absolutely, and I remember Garth last year, was it 2 years ago, with the last time he won it, I remember him saying, Luke, this is coming for you next. He said something like that.
Yeah, he did, and you know, that was very sweet of him to say that.
Absolutely. So I also want to ask, you know, I've read that, you know, you're up every morning at 5 a.m., you know,
yep.
You're checking, you know, the fan engagement, you're reading the news. I mean, can you walk us through your morning routine? You're up early, and then what's the first thing you do?
I'm up between 4:30 and 5 every day, and I get a coffee, and then I sit on the back deck of my house, and I pull up Twitter, and I will type in my artist's names, and I will read Twitter for the last 24 hours. And I think the reason why I do that is I get the best pulse of the fans, of what they're saying and that kind of stuff. And I just like to read it and just see what they're doing and talking about. Then I'll start coming in the emails, filing some stuff. And then I take some time in the morning. And then I, you know, by 8 o'clock, I've had, you know, 3 cups of coffee. I've had listening to some music. And I start my day. So,
now, what do you do when you're going through Twitter and you see, like, oh, love this, you know, this is a great song, remember that moment? Like when you're seeing that information, are you sending things to people? Are you, taking notes?
I file it away and just pay attention to what the fans are talking about. And or if I do, I'll reach out to our social media guy, Clinton, who's been with us from the beginning. And I'll say, hey, did you see this? Of course, the answer is yes. He sees everything before I do. I think I know what I think I'm one step ahead of him, and I'm actually behind him. So I just love to read what the fans are saying, and just I love to hear how the artists make the fans. They help them through a bad time. They help them through a good time. They help them cope with something. I don't know. It's amazing the relationship that the fans and the artists have. And I just like to study that, and it's pretty awesome.
Absolutely. Okay, so you go through Twitter, you send your emails, you're reading the news, 8 o'clock comes around, and then is it chaos from that point forward?
It can be. I always tell people that as a manager, your day, you think it's going to start out this way, and by 10 a.m., you can be going a completely different direction. You might get I need you text. All right, what do you need? I'm there. You might
any crazy I need you text that you can share?
No, I can't share them, but I've had them.
Fair enough.
I think that's the part of the manager that's a great role is that, you're the first call, and I love that. I love being that first call. My phone never gets turned off, ever. Because you never know when, that call in the middle of the night, you need to be ready at all times. And, if you want to be a manager, it's not 9 to 5. It's not 5 days a week. You don't get vacations. Your life is their life, but you have to be hardwired like that. Like, managers and chefs, you have to marry the idea of what you're doing. And I wouldn't have it any other way.
Are those oh crap calls in the middle of the night, or those emergency things? Have those increased or decreased during quarantine? Has that turned down a little bit?
I think it's more of the you also want to make sure that the mental wellness of everybody is good. So I mean, but it's funny, you deal with artists and their schedule is different than yours. You might have an artist that wakes up at noon and doesn't go to bed until 1. They might want to talk at 10 o'clock at night. That's right when they feel that they're at their best time. So I'm available at any time. I'll get a phone call that'll wake me up, or I'll get a phone call in the middle of the day. I'm going to talk whenever. What's good for you? Now, let's talk now. Tonight, let's talk tonight. I don't care. It's at their convenience, I know that sounds like, where's your time? You know what? I'll have time in a little while. I'm in a moment right now, like you use. I love that term. I'm in a moment, and I'm having fun.
Unbelievable. Yeah. That's a great line. I'm in a moment.
I'm in a moment. I'm having fun with it, so I'm going to keep embracing it. I'm not gonna stop from it at all. It's too exciting.
Absolutely. Now, of course, Europe is starting to embrace country music, maybe more and more than they ever have. I was over there earlier this year, and the fans are insane. With Luke Combs, it feels like, obviously, country is an American homegrown thing, but was an international strategy. When did that come to the picture for your artist, or for maybe Luke specifically?
Immediately. I mean, the very first thing I told Luke is we need to play the Midwest, and then we need to play the Northeast, and then we need to get to the West Coast as quickly as possible. In fact, I remember one of our first meetings with Lynn and I and everything, and Lynn's like, when are we playing California? And I'm like, as quickly as we can. And everybody looked at us like we had two heads, but we were like, which we actually did together. We had two. They were like, four. They were like, why do you guys want to play California so fast? And it's like, because we don't want to get stuck east of the Mississippi. Why do you want to get to Europe so fast? Well, because we don't want to get stuck just playing America. Why do you want to go to Australia so fast? Because we don't want to just play Canada. There's fans of music are everywhere. And that was a big strategy, was to get there as quickly as we could and plant our flag. And that's what we did. Australia is a huge market for us. Canada, massive. Europe, so is Europe. I mean, you just can't play all 50 states all the time. You got to get out there and get that music to everybody. And they love it. I mean, Europe loves Luke as much as Australia, as much as Canada, as much as Alabama. I mean, everybody loves them. So, and that's my artist. I want all of them to play. You know, Nico was overseas and was going to do this whole run through, you know, Europe and Australia and New Zealand and Japan before COVID hit. I mean, I was like, let's go. Let's put the pedal down. Let's get the music out there.
Absolutely. Do you notice that there's a difference between the songs that people love in different international territories?
Yeah, they do. They seem to go deeper on certain songs, and they try to gravitate to, I think European fans that I've at least watched a little bit love the songwriting process, and they dig into the lyrics. I think more maybe the American fans are into some melodies and the tempo of the song, but you gotta let the fans fall in love with the songs, and then you just listen to them and say, hey, that's the one you like, let's go with that one. You know, there's no better barometer than the fans. Like, you know, they're gonna tell you.
Absolutely.
No need to guess.
And I read recently that your artists are now on TikTok, or I'm assuming they have been for a minute. Is that platform paying dividends for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just another opportunity for them to show their art and let them be creative. And, you know, and I embrace it. Like, let's go, like Vine, you know, Vine started early, and that was six or seven seconds. That was great. To let them shine, TikTok is very cool. I think it's a fantastic medium. You know, when Instagram created IGTV, I love that. Longer moments to let the fans have that. Any way you can get the music out there and the opportunity to let the fan and the artist have a moment together, why wouldn't you do that?
Absolutely. So, of course, we mentioned Shep Gorin's story.
Sure.
Any other books, resources, podcasts, when you need inspiration, when you're looking to learn something, if you have downtime, any other pieces of content that you enjoy consuming?
Well, I'll tell you, I love the podcast Stuff You Should Know with Josh and Chuck. It's not music related, but it gives me so much information about trivia that I usually tend to win a lot. but I love their podcast. I think there's a book out called Everything You Want to Know About the Music Business. That's a great book.
Don Passman.
Yeah, I'll go back and reference that. I actually bought it for everybody on the staff a while ago and said, hey, you know, read this. Let's talk about it. But, you know, there's a couple of documentaries out there that I've watched. The one about Tower Records was awesome.
That is a great documentary, actually.
Great,
holy cow.
Great documentary. ZZ Top's documentary, amazing. Watched it. Ed Sheeran's, you know, the one about being a songwriter. I mean, a fantastic documentary. I love watching those. I mean, I think you can learn so much from the past that you can use today. So all of those are fantastic. But that Tower Records one was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
It really was. And I just watched the David Foster one a couple nights ago, which is also incredible. He was out of his mind in terms of how passionate he was about, you know, the artists he worked with and everything. But I thought it was inspiring. It was a highly recommend. Incredible movie.
I need to watch that one.
Do you look for, you know, other genres as well for inspiration for what to do with your artist? Are you constantly peeking into the pop world or anything else?
No, I think what I do is I kind of just, I mean, I hate to always go back to this, but I just look at the fans and I go to the artist and I'm like, I mean, nobody knows their fans better than the artist anyway. And, you know, we try to bring them great ideas. I mean, I go to a lot of the people inside my team. I go to a lot of people, you know, everybody, you know, gives advice, which is great. Like the label, we have an amazing label relationship with Sony for Luke and Nico, and with Big Loud for Ashland and Haley, and with, you know, Brother Sun Dance with Warner in LA. You know, we have great relationships with a lot of people, but I think, you know, you really go to the fans and you go to the artist, and, you know, it's going to happen organically. There's no need to contrive anything because, I mean, they know each other so well, and, you know, we get a lot of stuff from the fans. Hey, what about this? You know, that's a great idea. Let's run with that. So that's what we do. We just try to really have great opportunities to let both of them shine together.
Absolutely. Well, Captain, thank you so much for taking the time. I'll tell you a quick story. I'm probably about two years ago, I am sitting in the dentist chair. I'm having my wisdom teeth removed. and I've got my headphones on, my phone's on shuffle. I'm listening to anything, and I remember the dentist, you know, puts Novocaine in my mouth, and he says, "Your mouth is officially numb." And I thought that was the cheesiest line ever. And as if on cue, the moment he said that, "When it rains, it pours" comes onto my headphones, full blast. Luke Combs said, "Keep that." Quickly put on Luke Combs' first album. And it instantly made me feel a little bit more comfortable to be in that chair. That's maybe kind of a random story, but
to me,
you know, I think about that moment every time I hear Luke Combs, and that's just what he does. He makes you a little bit more comfortable, a little bit more fun, and he's an artist that you look at, and I think he makes you proud to be in music, because you can see what his music does to other people and what he's able to accomplish. And I think a lot of people hope for that level of engagement with the artists that they work with. So it's been so exciting to see what you guys have done over the past couple of years, and I'm sure it's the tip of the iceberg.
Well, thank you so much. You're right. It is amazing what those artists can do with their fans, and I think it's awesome. So I'm glad Luke helped you through that. He's helped me through some stuff. He's helped a lot of people through some stuff. So, Zach, I really appreciate it. And thank you for having me on, and this is a lot of fun catching up.
Talk to you soon. Drive safe.
Thank you, man. Have a great one.
Thanks again for tuning in, and thanks again to Cappy for taking the time to come onto the show. What a thrill. What a fun conversation. I'm so glad we were able to make it happen. I mean, that is, you know, management at its finest. That's top of the line. There are not many operating at that level in the management space. And man, it was a thrill to talk with Cappy all about it. So thanks again for everyone who tuned in. The Zach Kuhn Show is mixed by Sam Heyman, and our theme music is by Justin Johnson. Oh, wait, and by the way, fun fact about Justin Johnson. He just had the number one song in the country this week with Priscilla Block, which he produced. And I mean, it raises the whole bar of the show. I mean, it really does. Like, our theme music is by a number one producer. I'm pumped about it. If you haven't checked the song out, check it out. She's going to be on Bobby Bones today. Might have already happened by the time you listen to it. And again, I mean, come on, it raises the game. My theme music's by a number one producer. I don't know. It's a big deal. I'm pumped about it. Okay, that's it. That's all I got to say this week. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Bye. By the way, number one producer, is that it? That doesn't sound right. It's by a number one. My producer has had a number one. How do you say that? I don't even know. Okay.